We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're happy to have here on the program once again David Sinno. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And for some time now, on a regular basis, always on a Friday, he's been here to talk about money management. And the way we do this is he starts out, he has comments on a couple of things, and then we'll open it up to questions. And if you have questions on anything that he's going to discuss, that's fine. But anything else that has to do with financial planning and money management, call in and give us your background information and tell us your question, and Dave will tell you what he thinks. So with that, we say good morning and welcome back, and glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And I'd like to take this opportunity, of course, to wish all of the WILL family and friends a very joyous holiday season. Well, speaking of the holidays, perhaps we should begin with Mr. Grinch, better known as the Illinois Department of Revenue. You see, the revenue department is on the warpath. They are very unhappy with us, and they are very unhappy with literally millions of Illinois taxpayers who are eluding Illinois sales tax by buying online. Without much fanfare, the Illinois legislature, more than a year ago, passed legislation which basically says you owe Illinois sales tax on all of your internet purchases between the dates of June 20th, 2004, and going forward, really forever. And if you didn't pay sales tax on internet items during that period of time, well, if you pay up now for your past transgressions, we won't charge you a penalty. In fact, the state of Illinois intends to offer us a worksheet as part of our state income tax return in order to figure out exactly how much sales tax we owe, and oh yes, the amnesty period, so we don't get penalized, for catching up runs through October 15th of 2011. So all of us need to go back, David, apparently to 2004, and see if we bought online. Now, I'm sort of archaic and old-fashioned, so I probably didn't buy a whole lot back in 2004. Now, this whole issue arose because the United States Supreme Court back in 1992 ruled that a state can't force out-of-state retailers to collect sales tax from customers unless the retailer has a presence in the state. So let's take an example. Most of our listeners probably know that I like to fish. I'm a fisherman, and I occasionally purchase fishing equipment online from different internet sites, including, let's say, Bass Pro Shops. Since they have stores in Illinois, they have a physical presence in Illinois, and thus, when I place an order as an Illinois resident, I will be charged sales tax. They will collect sales tax. Of course, the question arises, how much money is the state of Illinois missing out on because of internet sales? Because of retailers who are not charging us sales tax because they have no physical presence, no bricks and mortar, no warehouses, no retail establishments in the state of Illinois. Now, estimates vary widely, but the Revenue Department recently released a study which suggested that the state of Illinois may be foregoing at least $150 million annually. And this number, of course, is likely to grow as internet sales geometrically expand. One conclusion does seem certain. Given Illinois' abysmal financial status, there will be increasing pressure placed on all Illinois residents to pay sales tax on all internet purchases. So we'll stay tuned on that one, and we'll see if Mr. Grinch raises his ugly head. Well, let's leave Mr. Grinch and turn to Mr. Santa Claus, who is no other than the United States Congress. With both the Senate earlier this week and the House passage in just the last few hours, we now have something called the Tax Hike Prevention Act of 2010. I love these names. This one, the Tax Hike Prevention Act of 2010. Well, it now appears that all of us, all of our citizenry, is about to receive tax bounties, savings, and gifts of almost, get a load of this number, $1 trillion over the next decade. Of course, never mind the deficit and our inability to face up to our looming debt crisis. Why, I think there's something in this holiday package for just about everyone. So let's take a brief look at just some of these new tax changes and or breaks that are coming our way starting January 1. First, current tax rates are extended just about, well, they're extended for everyone for at least the next 2 years. Estimated cost, estimated hit to the Treasury, a mere $200 billion. Second, let's take a look at Social Security and a new Social Security tax break for wage earners. For 2011 only, this is a one-year goodie, the payroll tax rate on workers will be reduced from the current rate of 6.2% to 4.2%. Now, it doesn't get reduced on employers, but it gets reduced on employees. For example, a worker earning $50,000 would save $1,000 of Social Security taxes in 2011. Estimated cost of this change, approximately $110 to $120 billion for the year. And of course, if we examine the trustees' report on Social Security, we're seeing really for the first time that Social Security is already suffering a negative cash flow, and that is there's more dollars going out than are coming in from payroll taxes. And I guess this will just add another $110 to $115 billion to that little deficit. Third, expanded child tax credits, which will allow many folks, even for the first time, to claim the credit and actually receive a tax refund. Estimated cost? Only $90 to $100 billion. In the past, some of these credits, you couldn't use them as a refund. In other words, if your income was zero and you were entitled to a tax credit, which is a dollar-for-dollar reduction against taxes, you didn't get an actual refund. Now, under the new rules, if your taxable income turns out to be zero and you're still entitled to a child tax care credit, why, my goodness, you're going to get a little Treasury check in the mail. Again, that one somewhere between $90 and $100 billion. Very importantly, unemployed workers will receive a potential 13 months of additional unemployment benefits. So in some states, unemployed residents will be able to claim up to 99 weeks of unemployment benefits. Estimated cost? A mere $60 billion. Fifth, and clearly the most contentious change, is the increase of the amount of the estate that is no longer subject to estate tax. In 2009, someone could pass away and leave an estate essentially of $3.5 million not subject to federal estate tax. In 2010, it apparently went poof, like the magic dragon. It just went away. So you could leave a very, very large estate with no federal estate tax. And now the number is going to $5 million. So an individual can leave $5 million exclusive of what that individual leaves to a surviving spouse or charity, and that next $5 million will not be subject to estate tax. In addition, the actual estate tax rate has been reduced. It was scheduled to go back to 55% of the taxable estate in 2011, and now it's going to be 35%. So that little bailout, that little cost, why, that's only $70 billion. And the truth of the matter is less than 0.25% of all people who die in the United States actually pay estate tax. So this is clearly something that is going to benefit wealthier taxpayers. Now, keep in mind, as we go through these things, most of these changes are only for 2 years. These aren't forever. So we're going to be revisiting all of these issues again during the next 24 months. Now, these are just some of the more prominent provisions brought to you in a brokered agreement between the administration and the Congress. So all I can say is happy holidays from Mr. Santa Claus. Happy holidays, America. And finally, each month, we revisit our couch potato portfolio, our stock index portfolio, which of course can be accessed on the WILL website. Click on Focus, click on Couch Potato, and it has been actually updated this morning through last night's close. Frankly, it's been a very solid year for stocks in general, and in particular, our portfolio of 8 U.S. and international stock indexes. Through last night's close, our portfolio year-to-date is a positive 16.6% as compared to our benchmark S&P 500, which is also up 13.5%. Not bad either. In other words, our diversification has added about, well, it's added about 3% to the overall rate of return this year. So once again, I have to wish happy holidays to the global stock market. For those people who are invested in stocks, that's been a good thing for our 401ks. It's been especially a good thing for pensioners who are in the state of Illinois pension systems because a large sum of that money is invested in stocks, and that certainly will help the funding deficit in those pension programs. Well, there you have it, David. The Illinois Department of Revenue, the U.S. Congress, the Obama administration, taxes, 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 stocks, stocks, stocks. I'd be happy to answer questions about issues I've raised or tackle other questions on the minds of our listeners.
All right. David Sano is here. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And on Friday, once a month, he's here. We talk about money management. We'll be happy to take calls. We have several people ready to go. Again, we want to try to be thorough in answering people's questions. But, of course, people can also help us by being brief. That way we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have several callers ready to go. We'll take them in the order they came in. Line number one is someone in Urbana. Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Yes, go ahead.
In a previous program, you talked about a way to get more interest in a certain investment, but I don't remember what it was, and I find that the CDs, money market funds, and even my checking account are down about, you know, the checking account is 25% of 1%. And
boy, that's a tough question.
CDs are like 1 and 2%. So.
They certainly are. That's a tough question. I might have suggested within the context of the question asked as part of an overall asset allocation is a short-term corporate bond fund, a short-term corporate bond fund, and a corporate bond fund which has high-quality investment-grade investments in it. That has been very good as an investment over the last 36 to 48 months, but I'm concerned that in the fund that you choose, that the average maturity of those bonds should be no greater than 24 months. There are a number of mutual funds that meet that criteria, and I think as part of an overall asset allocation strategy, that would make some sense.
And what would be the interest on those? I thought you said something like 3%.
Probably about 1% to 1.5% greater than you would typically earn in the same length certificate of deposit.
Okay. And this is a short-term...
corporate.
Corporate.
High-quality.
Corporate bond fund.
Yep, high-quality. High, high-quality.
High-quality.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I guess that answers my question.
All right. Happy holidays.
Well, just real quick now, what can you get these days in a money market mutual fund?
In a money market mutual fund, about 0.2%. And that's because most money market funds are invested in very short-term instruments like commercial paper. Okay. Commercial paper is short-term corporate IOU paper that is used by corporations to essentially fund day-to-day activities. And if we look at the commercial paper market, right now, 30 to 44-day commercial paper is paying 17/100ths of 1%. So you can imagine what that translates into your money market fund. Slim pickings, my friend, mm-hmm. not very mm-hmm. much. This has been an enormous problem for retired people. because the government has been recapitalizing banks on the backs of people who are generally lenders, who are retired people who have lent their money, and they are lending it essentially to the banks in the form of deposits. They are lending it to corporations in the form of a money market fund at tiny, tiny interest rates. And this has allowed a huge part of our economy to rebuild itself, if you will.
All right. Line two is next, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question. As a new CSRS member, I have a choice of getting a low pension check or taking a lump sum that would be the equivalent of 10 years of this very small check. And I was wondering, given the state of CSRS in the state of Illinois, if it would be smarter to take the lump sum and invest it, and what would be the best way to invest it?
Yeah, that's, again, a difficult question depending upon your personal circumstances. But generally, interestingly enough, at least 90% of the time, you will be better off with the pension than investing.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. With CSRS, regardless of their fiscal situation, remember that each year you are entitled to a 3% adjustment on that pension amount. So it is an increasing amount each year. Now, could that change? Possibly. But at least at the moment, we can only deal with the facts as we know them. And it would be very, very difficult to find an investment that is going to continue to increase each year. So most of the time, and I would suggest that you sit down with a financial advisor, have them examine it mathematically for you, but most of the time, you will be better off taking the annuitized pension than the lump sum. It's okay. Very tough in this market to reinvest that money and earn that pension benefit. How old are you?
62.
Okay. At 62, your life expectancy is likely into the 90s, especially if you have a long lifeline or you are in good health. And again, if you start to extrapolate that pension out at some kind of increasing rate on an annualized basis, it would be very, very tough to take the present value dollars of that amount and invest it in your own self-directed IRA and get the same rate of return.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Very good. Thank you. Let's see. Our next caller would be Piatt County. This is someone on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I'll try to be brief.
Okay.
We bought what's called a unique property on 3 acres 4 years ago and got a loan from a small-town bank at, I thought, pretty good rates. It has an old house on the property that we had to fill in the well, so because we dug a new well. And so then when it came time to refinance with these rates, we went with a mortgage company in Champaign and took all our paperwork in, and were told that we had gotten the loan. It was October 29th, but because of the old house on it, we're told they had to appeal, and because they're saying that it's a second property on, you know, a second house on our property, even though we provided the Piatt County assessor wrote a letter, and I'm just wondering. If this loan doesn't go through, we haven't heard much from the mortgage company.
Okay, I'm not certain that I understand the fact pattern. This is a unique property. How many?
It's a renovated barn.
So it's a renovated barn. And is there another house on this property?
Yes, that
okay.
is not hooked up.
And is the
well.
Other
yeah.
is the other house occupied? Is someone living in
it? No, it couldn't be occupied, and the Piatt County assessor has written a letter to that effect. There's no water to it.
All right. So what we're really talking about is a barn that has been improved, and
mm-hmm.
is it now
renovated,
a
yes.
And is it now a residential home?
Yes, mine, yes.
So you are living in it?
Yes.
As your residential home?
Yes, as my main residence.
Okay, and the mortgage company is having an issue because of this other property that is also located on it?
Yeah, he said that will the loan be sold off to Fannie Mae? Is that, he said that the underwriter is saying that this is the second property. It's so very confusing to me because that was, like I said, October 29th, and it's now in December, and we haven't heard, even though we were cleared for the loan, we were told.
I'm afraid I really can't answer that question because
okay.
each underwriter has different uh-huh. underwriting standards.
Uh-huh.
It seems to
okay.
me that if you have provided the underwriter with information that says that basically it's just a secondary structure that is unoccupied, will never be occupied on the property, that your principal residence, regardless of what else is on the property, is your principal residence, and you should be able to obtain a loan on that principal residence. So I'm a bit surprised. On the other hand,
I am too, yes.
On the other hand, perhaps you should go back to your mortgage broker. And are you dealing with a mortgage bank or a mortgage broker?
Broker.
Okay. So that mortgage broker has other sources generally
mm-hmm.
for underwriting. And if you can't get the job done at one place, maybe your broker can get the job done with a second underwriter.
Okay. So if we are turned down for this loan, then would it be worth it to go through our original small town bank, which we kind of preferred not to? Because of some just personal issues?
Well, there are any number of banks that you can go to.
Uh-huh.
All right? It doesn't matter whether it's your own small-town bank or another bank. I don't think that's the relevant
yeah.
issue. Someone should be able to help you. You may have run into an underwriter who has different underwriting requirements and says simply that we're not able to make this loan or accommodate it. But by this time, your broker should find out specifically and level
okay,
with you. Either you're going to get this loan or you're not.
Yeah, well, as soon as people hear barn, it tends
slows
to
them down.
People not be happy, yeah.
It slows them down, sure.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry that I'm not more help, but
no,
I would...
Oh, you're a great help, actually. I just wanted to know that we wouldn't be seen as a poor credit risk because we had been turned down.
Absolutely not. Absolutely
okay.
not. This is strictly a function of the uniqueness of the property.
Okay. Well, you have been a good help. Thank you so much.
All right. Well,
my pleasure.
Thanks for the call. We are already at our midpoint here. David Sino is our guest. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month on a Friday, we do these programs on money management and personal finance. And he does his best to help people out and answer questions. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we have a caller in Niles, and that's line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Professor, and happy holidays to you both.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could give me your opinion of, it's actually a two-part question, your opinion of dividend income funds versus balance funds, and would you know of a ETF that's associated with agriculture, as I perceive this is going to be a big issue in the future?
Well, first of all, there may be a place in your portfolio for a mutual fund which is a dividend income-oriented fund.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many people are looking for higher yields by looking at dividend or higher dividend-paying stocks.
Yes.
And indeed, many mutual funds now offer these types of funds. Fidelity, for example, comes to mind. Any of the large mutual fund companies will offer a dividend-paying fund. And, of course, if you believe that the economy is expanding, if capacity utilization is increasing, if these indicators truly are going to continue to point up, then that signals good news for companies, and they will be able to continue to pay dividends. Also, with the passage of the Tax Act, at least for the next 2 years, dividends will continue to enjoy a tax-favored status. In other words, most of these dividends are going to be taxed at the 15% rate as opposed to the marginal income tax rate.
Yes.
So they are going to continue to be favored. So I don't have a problem with a high-quality dividend fund. Now, a balanced fund is really more of an asset allocation fund. It does a lot of the work for us. And typically in a balanced fund, it will be comprised of stocks somewhere between the 40 and 60% level and bonds somewhere between the 40 and 60% level. So it really is a different kind of animal the Balanced Fund is really there to provide a intelligent asset allocation, and the Dividend Fund is where you're really looking for income. Can you do both? Why, of course. Would it be reasonable to do both? Absolutely. Now, with regard to your agriculture question, agriculture is usually considered real estate. So if you were looking to invest in agriculture, you might want to be looking at real estate investment trusts, REITs, and you could probably Google agricultural REITs or agricultural public REITs, and you could take a look at those. I don't know off the top of my head, perhaps a caller does know, whether or not there is an ETF just for agriculture, but typically not, because agriculture is a semi-illiquid investment. There's lots of buyers for farmland, but it doesn't trade like a security. So typically there would not be an exchange-traded fund that is just buying and selling liquid securities. You'd be more likely to look for an agricultural real estate investment trust investment. And I'm guessing, although I haven't looked myself, I'm guessing they are out there with a little bit of research. But those are all excellent questions.
Okay, Doctor. I also, without taking any more time, had a view towards the products produced by the farms as opposed to the land itself. Do you have any thoughts about that? Any funds?
Well, again, you're now talking about the actual commodities, and that's a whole different ballgame. I have always believed that people who are interested in investing or playing commodities markets should have a darn good reason for doing that. And there are only two good reasons, in my view. Either you are a producer of the product, you're a producer of corn, soybeans, pork, cattle, etc., so you want to hedge your position, or alternatively, you're an end user of those products, a cereal manufacturer. And they know, for example, how much oats, wheat, corn they're going to need, so they hedge those positions. I think for everyone else, to be honest about it, you're a gambler. And gamblers, in the end, 9 out of 10 lose. So I'm not very high on your going in and taking risks in commodities.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Good
All right.
advice.
Thank you for the call. We have a couple of other callers here. I have a question that came in by email, and I'm not sure how involved it is. Maybe I'll ask the question. You can tell me how much time it might take. Someone wants to know, in view of the changes, the tax law changes that you talked about at the beginning with this deal that the president worked out, they want to know, could you possibly review the Roth conversion situation? Does that have any impact on that?
Not really. With the Roth conversion, there is now the opportunity, regardless of your income, to roll directly from a retirement fund, typically a 401k, a 403b, a profit-sharing plan, directly into a Roth. If you choose to do that, you still have the choice. If you do it this year, in 2009, you have the choice of paying the tax all at once in April of 2011. If you do it in December of 2010, still have a little time, you would then pay all the tax in April of 2011. Or alternatively, you can make the election to pay half the tax in the 2011 year and half the tax in the 2012 year. So you would be putting that tax off really until April of 2012 and April of 2013. Since those tax rates are going to stay the same, then if you make that election, you might as well put off paying those taxes until later on. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, another possibility is to move from a retirement plan and roll into your own self-directed IRA. So let's say we had $100,000 in a retirement plan, and we rolled tax deferred into our traditional self IRA, our self-directed IRA. Haven't paid any tax. Now we can take some of that money. We don't have to take all of it. We could take $30,000 of it. and we could roll that $30,000 of the $100,000 into a Roth, and then we would pay taxes on that $30,000. So it's not an all or nothing proposition. There are a number of choices, but at least it's a little easier because these tax rates really haven't changed. Keep in mind again, however, that if you rolled all of your money into a Roth, it is all taxable, so it could push you into higher income tax brackets. So many, many times, it's better to roll into a traditional IRA and then slowly, each year, roll some of it out of your traditional IRA into a Roth so you don't bump up against higher tax rates and getting into that next marginal tax bracket. So a rather difficult question. I guess that's a fairly difficult answer. Bottom line, consult your financial advisor. That really is the bottom line.
All right. We have some other callers. Someone here who's next on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm interested in, one, what your opinion is of the muni market in, say, the next 3-4 years. And also, if you're buying either a corporate or a muni bond, how, you know, sometimes they'll offer you a discount, sometimes they won't. How do you know if they're always being upfront with you or there could have been a discount, but, you know, they don't offer it?
And that's a great question. You raised a lot of great questions. Let's talk about muni bonds in general. In my view, unless you are a professional, unless you are an expert, you want to stay with very, very high quality, what are called GOs, General Obligation Municipal Bonds. A GO municipal bond is backed by the full faith and credit of the taxing authority of the issuer. All right? What's an example? Champaign school district bonds. Those are backed by the real estate taxes or the sales taxes of Champaign County or of the school district. So if bonds are issued by a school district, they are typically backed by a bond referendum and higher real estate taxes. That's an example of a GO or a general obligation municipal bond. They rarely default. They have a 99.5% certainty of not defaulting. And I think the real issue today with municipal bonds for the first time is the potential of default on those particular bonds. In addition, while the interest rates are lower, I like bonds that mature somewhere between 2 and 7 years. I'm not interested in going out and buying a municipal bond that matures in 20, 25, or 30 years. Just too many things can happen along the way. So I like shorter-term municipal bonds that are typically general obligation municipal bonds. So that's my feeling about the municipal bond market. Recently, it's been beat up. People have been leaving these bonds in search of the stock market out of fear of default. But generally, people have not been leaving high-quality general obligation municipal bonds. So those would be the kind of bonds that I would buy, either directly from my broker or through a very high-quality muni bond fund. With respect to what you pay, when you have a broker essentially saying, you can buy this bond for 98 cents on the dollar, for $1.01 on the dollar, there is a difference between what the bond is being offered to you at and what the bond can be sold at. There is an offer price offered to you and a bid price at which you sell. And there can be a very substantial spread, which you really have no control over in when you buy or you sell your municipal bond. It's very, very difficult because it's not a totally transparent market. And also, if you are buying a new issue, a brand new issue, which really hasn't started trading yet, again, there are markups and spreads in those bonds, and you really don't have any ability to reduce the price to yourself. You just don't, you and I, as individuals, just don't have enough buying power, if you will, to impact those spreads. But you can bet that people on Wall Street and the brokerage firms, they're entitled to a commission. They're entitled to making money on the sale of that bond. In a new issue, if you are buying that bond at par, at 100, you can bet that the issuer, for example, the school district or ABC company, they're not receiving that dollar. They're receiving something less than the dollar because the underwriters and the brokers are taking a spread, and that's where they make their money. So I hope that helps a little bit, but the real message is stay with very, very high-quality municipal bond instruments, typically general obligation bonds.
Thank you.
All right, and another caller here, Kankakee County. This is line two. Hello.
Hello, yes. Gentlemen.
Yes.
The previous caller answered a lot of my question. My question is about municipal bond funds. I'm pretty heavily invested in one of the municipal bond funds, and I noticed that it went down about 2% last month. What's your opinion of the future of?
Well, first of all, municipal bond funds, like any bond fund, is very interest rate sensitive. If you believe that interest rates are trending up, and indeed for the past 5 weeks, interest rates have trended up, then what happens to your bonds is they move directly in the opposite direction. There's an inverse relationship between the direction of bonds and interest rates. So as interest rates go up, bonds go down. That's because people don't like the bonds as well, because they have lower interest rate coupons. So let's sell those, let's liquidate those, and buy ones that have higher interest rate coupons. Now, what really impacts a bond fund is the average maturity and something called the average duration of the bond funds. And suffice it to say, without going into the theoretical background of what those terms really mean, shorter-term bond funds, funds that have maturities of their bonds that are shorter as opposed to longer, will have less volatility, will have less movement in the share price of the fund. So if you are holding a very long-term bond fund where the average bond matures in 15, 20, even 25 or 30 years, you are going to be subjecting yourself to more volatility in that bond fund. Admittedly, you're getting a little bit of a higher interest rate or dividend rate on your fund, but clearly more volatility. So what I would ask whoever is advising you, or you can do this research on your own, is ask about average maturity and average duration of the bond funds you're in, and you might slowly, if they are very, very long-term funds, shift some of that money to shorter-term bond funds. You'll have less volatility in the shareholder price.
Let me ask you, sir, my fund is intermediate-term municipal. What would the average maturity be on those?
Well, we'd have to see the fund. It might be as low as 7 years. It might be as high as 15 to 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a lot happier with funds that have a maturity closer to 7 years than 15 to 18 years.
Okay.
So call, if you're in a bond fund, call the family of funds and ask them specifically what is the average maturity. And also ask them what is the average duration. Duration simply refers to how fast those interest payments really get paid to you.
I see.
So that's really what that means.
So in the bond market, when interest rates go up generally,
bonds funds will
bonds.
Go down. If you
but, I
own,
mean, do municipal bonds usually follow along?
Absolutely.
They do.
Sure, because people are going to demand higher interest rates on their municipal bonds.
Well, you've been very helpful. I appreciate it.
All right.
You're entirely
you.
Welcome.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He is a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month, he's on the program. We talk about money management and investing. And if you have a financial issue you'd like to discuss, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send along your question by email. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. I was just curious. I want to go back. At the very beginning, you mentioned the thing about how now the Illinois Department of Revenue is saying to people in Illinois that they're expecting you to look at all of the online purchases that you have made going all the way back to 2004.
About the middle of 2004, correct.
And to report them and to pay tax.
Absolutely.
With the qualification that if you are dealing online with some kind of retailer that has a presence in Illinois, for example.
You probably already pay.
So you go online to Sears. Well, they were supposed to get it from you. That's not the issue. You go online to L.L. Bean, that's another deal.
No question.
But I'm thinking now you would have to be a very disciplined record keeper, I think, to be able to say, well, yeah, I think I probably did, but I don't remember what I did in 2004. I don't have my credit card statements anymore from 2004. I couldn't tell you. How do they expect people to do this, and are they really going to try to track people down, particularly if we're talking about a pretty small amount? You know, we could be talking about $5,
absolutely,
$10,
David.
a very small amount of money.
Absolutely. You've raised great questions. No one has the answers to the questions. Here's how it's going to happen. If the state of Illinois somehow, for example, audits either an individual or audits a company, and that company then releases their list of customers who have purchased online and they are state of Illinois residents, then perhaps, and this hasn't been worked out, haven't seen any regulations, haven't seen any rules how this is going to be enforced, then under that scenario, then the state of Illinois might send you a letter that says, according to our information, right? That's about as good as it's going to get. So compliance is a real issue here, isn't it? You're raising the issue of compliance and how likely is it that people are going to comply. I think going forward, people are more likely to comply. Going retroactive, pretty difficult.
Yeah. Now, I can't quite imagine, the state of Illinois going to somebody like L.L. Bean and saying, we'd like you to cough up the information on everything Illinoisans have bought over the last 6 years. Can you do that for us? They'd probably say, what, are you kidding? And although the thing is, and I'm sure that other states face the same situation, they feel like they're losing a lot of tax revenue. They've lost a lot of tax revenue.
And also, what about the business person who has the bricks and mortar, all right, and it's costing them more to have that product at retail than the retailer who simply has an internet online service? Like Amazon.
All right. Well, we'll leave that for the moment and go back to the phones and talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
Back on municipal bonds and not through a group, but just a municipal bond. I have purchased those over the years because they were both state and federal tax exempt.
Yes.
Now, Illinois, I'm sorry to report, is in terrible condition. What are the chances that they're going to in some way belly up and say, oh, we can't continue paying you the interest on this because we are in bad shape?
Well, so you own some of the state of Illinois municipal bonds.
Yes. Well, it's like
Illinois Housing Development Authority.
Yes.
Those kinds of bonds.
Yes, and they're all both tax exempt. And I thought, oh, that's a great deal.
It is. IHDAs are both, they're double tax exempt, state and federal, and they have been historically an excellent investment,
right,
as well as a laudable thing to do because your money is actually being used to provide mortgage financing for people who otherwise couldn't afford conventional mortgage financing.
Are they as safe as they used to be?
I think they're pretty safe.
Okay.
I think they're pretty safe. I don't think you should lose sleep over it because the state of Illinois would be in an awful fix if they defaulted on bonds. They could probably would have an awful time borrowing again. So the more likely fix is going to be higher taxes down the road.
Uh-huh.
That's the more likely fix.
Okay.
And additional belt tightening.
Okay. I thank you very much, and I like what you say.
All right. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Over to Indiana, a caller here, line four. Hello.
Yes. This isn't quite an investment question, but I've been looking for someone to explain to me, when they talk about QE2, how does that actually get to the consumer or to stimulate this money? Is the Treasury borrows the prints the money?
Treasury,
how does that work?
Treasury prints some money.
Uh-huh. Then they hang up.
No, well, that's all right. The Treasury prints some money. Get a load of that. $500 billion, $600 billion, $700 billion. No additional productivity in the economy. Let's be real clear on that. So we have increased the money supply. And what we do is we buy treasuries. We buy treasuries. So the Federal Reserve now takes that money and puts it on their balance sheet and said, oh, my. Why? Now I have another $500, $600, $700 billion of treasuries that are no longer in the marketplace. So maybe one of those treasuries was mine. And now I have money, cash. What am I going to do with that money? Well, the hope is that I'm going to go out and spread it with a lot of Christmas cheer and largesse. And that is going to stimulate the economy. That's the theory. That's the theory. And by taking these high interest rate treasuries out of the marketplace, then there will be lower treasury interest securities left over. And the theory is that that somehow is going to depress interest rates. Well, interestingly enough, since they have started QE2, precisely the opposite has happened. Now, there may not be a causal relationship, but the bottom line is that interest rates each week since the beginning of quantitative easing has actually gone up in the U.S. of A. This has had a dilatory impact on mortgage rates, for example, which about 6 weeks ago, a 30-year mortgage was about 4.25% at historic lows. Today, 4.75%. And I think pretty soon we're going to once again see 5% mortgage rates, a terrible, terrible result for the housing industry and people who want to sell their houses or people who want to buy the houses. Because every week when those interest rates actually go up, more and more people get crowded out of being able to finance a home. There will be fewer buyers for homes. And I think one of the impacts of QE2 that people hadn't thought about, well, maybe the Fed really had thought about this, is the fact that it is going to have a more negative impact on housing prices. So while I'm usually not in the prediction business, and I hate to go out on a limb, but if someone was holding a gun to my head, I think in the major metropolitan areas of this country that housing prices have not bottomed, and it would not surprise me if interest rates continue to trend up, that we're going to see another 5 to 10% decrease in the value of housing stock in certain areas of the country. A horrible result, a horrible result. All brought to you courtesy of QE2, the Federal Reserve, and a whole bunch of other people who think they are making an intelligent move. But my view is that it has not been an intelligent move. It was not necessary. It was not a good idea.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left here. We've got an email from someone who wants to know, could you give your opinion regarding buying U.S. Treasury notes?
Well, U.S. Treasury notes are trending up. And especially in the 10-year range, they have moved up significantly. So I think they're going to move up some more. So if I was going to be a buyer of U.S. Treasury notes, I would probably be a buyer after the first of the year. But there certainly is a place in the portfolio for U.S. Treasury notes. You know, again, they're not going to default. We know that. The only issue is inflation risk, and that's true of any fixed income instrument. When you get paid back, when you get that principal back, what does it buy? It probably buys less than when it bought what it would have bought when you made that investment. So any fixed income investment is subject to interest rate risk, and it's subject to inflation risk. And corporates are subject, for example, to even default risk. But we don't have that problem with U.S. Treasury instruments.
What do you know, just offhand, what it is they're paying now?
See, a 10-year U.S. Treasury is about between 3.5% and 3.75% interest. That's up significantly from 6 to 8 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And usually, mortgage rates follow the 10-year Treasury. You can usually add about 150 to 200 basis points or 1.5% to 2% onto that 10-year Treasury rate to get an idea of what future mortgage rates are going to be. And that suggests that future mortgage rates are going to be in excess of 5%.
So I suppose some people might look at that and say, well, you know, given what you can do with certificates of deposit, that doesn't look so bad. And given the fact that if you think that the country is not going to collapse, that you should get your money when the time comes. The other thing is, though, that you are looking at making a 10-year commitment.
Absolutely. And again, I don't think the country – is going to collapse.
Let's hope not.
I don't think the company store is going to collapse. I'm not too concerned about that. Are we going to see higher inflation down the road? Absolutely. Can anyone believe these labor statistic numbers that over the last 12 months we've had 1% inflation? Don't think so. Cost of education, cost of Medicare, cost of every item that I buy has gone up a whole lot more than 1%.
Well, we have, I don't know, about 30 seconds a minute. Any last thing that you might like to leave with folks this time around?
Well, I think the good news is that markets are improving. Capacity utilization is increasing. Leading economic indicators are increasing. Numbers of jobs and job prospects are increasing. And let's all of us hope, obviously, that those trends continue into the new year and that interest rates don't put a damper on this holiday party.
All right. Well, with that, we'll say thanks to our guest, David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. He's here once a month. We talk about personal finance, money management, and we guess we'll see you in January.
Thanks, David. It's always fun.